Welcome to Community Matters, a podcast about the power of music community. My name is McKeegan Voice. In an era of streaming and AI and algorithmic discovery, sometimes we forget that there are humans behind the music. On Community Matters, we're chatting with artists who share their stories and how community has impacted their music careers, especially in times of struggle. A supportive community is one of the things that inspires us to start making music and then keep making it. And this is an ode to those relationships. We hope it's a reminder of just how important people are to the music that we love. Today I'm speaking with Elliot Sharp. Elliot has been one of the key figures in the avant-garde and experimental scenes in New York City since the late 1970s. And with close to 100 releases that span free jazz, noise, orchestral, no wave, contemporary classical, and electronic music, his career can really only be described as prolific. He studied with icons like Morton Feldman, Roswell Rudd, and Robert Moog. His compositions have been performed by renowned ensembles like the Kronos and Flux Quartets. He's released music for the alt-rock SST label alongside bands like Sonic Youth and Husker Du. And he's collaborated with everyone from jazz legend Jack Dejanet to Blondie's Debbie Harry to Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, the Pakistani Qawwali singer regarded as having one of the most impressive voices ever recorded. And today Elliot's living in Manhattan, still working on new music. And like the rest of us, he's adjusting to the new normal imparted by COVID-19. And that's where we jump in.
My daily operations haven't changed that much with all of this because I would be at home, I'd be cooking, being a dad, I'd come to the studio, I'd compose and record and go back home, punch in, you know, cook dinner. It's not that different now.
Right.
Especially, I mean, when I'm not on tour, I'm pretty much just dug in the studio, bunkered. And in fact, some of my friends' nickname for my studio is the bunker. So I'm in this building where my studio is where Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac and William Burroughs used to live in the 50s tradition. You know? But what this does bring up, though, you know, my mother is a Holocaust survivor. Yeah. And so growing up, we were often told about her days, more than days, really months and months, being hidden by French farmers in Alsace-Lorraine, her and her mother. And her father was in a concentration camp, which he survived. And her sisters and her brother were all hidden by different people. So it's very resonant for me, although we're not facing anything as immediate as instant death. You know, it's still quite daunting. And as an older person, I feel like I'm in a high-risk group, so I am trying to be careful. A popular meme, the old Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. You know, I kind of like boring times. It allows me to focus on the things that are my priorities these days, which is composing, recording, trying to create art. Of course, having that urgency of a life that is upended sometimes adds to the art, sometimes takes away. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a bit under the gun now. I'm composing an opera that's to premiere in November in Germany, assuming everything goes according to plan. I'm trying to get the libretto finished, trying to get the music written. Then there's the electroacoustic component, the video component, which is all done by my partner, Janine Higgins, and then getting all the scores and parts to the musicians and the singer.
Yeah. I can imagine that that's really difficult when you're preparing with a sense of urgency for something that you're not certain is going to happen on schedule.
Right. The one thing, though, I mean, that's good about composing under these conditions, the premise of the opera is that Beethoven, who was always a bit delusionary and probably suffered from syphilis and was really quite ill and his deafness, of course, quite a difficult person. I mean, in his latter days in Vienna, he wouldn't bathe. He was known for his uncut hair, even in the middle of summer, wearing this long coat and this big black hat with his long greasy hair, you know. And he would go from extreme poverty to extreme popularity and affluence, you know, sometimes within a year. And in the opera, he goes into these fugue states that brings him into our time, and he sees everything that's going on, and he brings this back to his compositional process in Vienna there while he's working on the Grosse Fuge, which to me is the first contemporary string quartet. And so that's what he is doing. He's bringing these seeds of our times back into his music.
Oh, that's an incredible idea. I love that. And I hope things smooth out and yes. You know, you're able to...
for hopes for everybody, you know?
Yes.
You know, I mean, we have, as they say, first world problems.
Right.
I mean, I certainly took a huge hit with canceled festival appearances. I was supposed to teach in France for a week. I mean, I really major problems, but I'm still able to cope with it. I still have enough of a padding. We're able to get by all right. But for many people, it's an absolute disaster.
Yeah. And this is a trying time for creatives who rely on communities and meeting with communities in physical spaces, you know, especially musicians who obviously aren't getting compensated fairly through streaming platforms or, you know, music consumption. You know, this is the primary source of revenue that all of a sudden doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I think most musicians know that they can't make a living performing in clubs in New York. It's worse now than it was when I first moved here in 1979. You know, club owners were appreciative of musicians. You'd play at the Pyramid Club and you'd make really great money and be treated very well. You know, all of these places that we used to play at. And now, you know, they act as if they're doing musicians a favor to allow them to pay to play. You know?
Yeah, it's crazy.
But don't get me started.
Yeah.
When one looks at the music business, it's a ridiculous model, especially for artists, if you approach it as an artist first. I mean, I was training to be a scientist as a child. I mean, science was my first love, and I'm still deeply interested in it. And I had a grant to be a scientist's assistant in 1968 when I was 17. And I did this at Carnegie Mellon University. And it was incredible in many ways. I had access to, you know, wonderful thinkers and colleagues in the lab. Mostly, I spent my time in the lab designing and building better fuzz boxes because I had just gotten an electric guitar.
Cool.
Before had left for Pittsburgh. And I got a gig on the radio station, midnight to 4 a.m. They had an incredible library. The 60s was a fantastic time for music. It was just exploding. And the more I dug into it, the more I had to dig into it. It was really an exponential dive into a wormhole. And at a certain point, I realized that music was what I had to be doing. I spent some time studying music formally, first at Cornell University, although there I was an anthropology major. And when I switched to Bard College to actually study music with Roswell Broad, as well as studying physics and electronics, the world that Roswell opened up into me, he really was one of the great free jazz trombonists, a great musicologist, and a musical historian whose knowledge and his direct experience embraced non-Western musics, Thelonious Monk, Duke Ellington, Archie Shepp, Ornette Coleman, you know, the wildest, you know, fringes of free jazz.
Mm-hmm.
So Roswell was really a great resource. And again, when I was doing graduate work, studying with Morton Feldman and Lajarin Hiller and Charles Kyle, who, as it turns out, was Roswell's first cousin, and also someone deeply involved in ethnomusicology and community building. That notion of music as a force that defines communities was very much integral to the creation of the music itself, both the way we played music, the way we formed bands, the way we set up gigs. Of course, you had to do gigs for money that were kind of normal gigs. You play in clubs and bars, you know, whatever. But you also did gigs to organize benefits for political things, Attica, political prisoners, for food co-ops, for everything. It was a normal part of our life as a musician. You couldn't separate music from politics and culture. And the communities were defined very easily by who you played music with, what kind of music you played, even how you dressed, although that was fairly superficial. But it was every aspect of our life. When I moved to New York, feet on the ground community organizing was very much a part of it. Because when we first got here, there were very few clubs that were interested in extreme music. There were a few, and of course, those were great resources. But we were very much involved in developing alternative spaces, lofts, galleries, finding ways to present music in non-typical spaces. What this did was bring many different constituencies together, not just people who were interested in avant-garde music, but visual artists, sculptors, people who were involved in what became known as sound art, performance artists, poets, filmmakers, you know, video, which was in a nascent stage then too, you know, everybody really. And the best thing about it was because it was always involved in public spaces, it was about face-to-face contact. And this is the thing that's changing very much. I mean, certainly now we see it very dramatically with the coronavirus. Mm-hmm. It's all online. People are separated. People are isolated. I've always believed that creative forces involve a certain amount of chemical mixing, you know, pheromones, people mixing bodily fluids, you know, in bars.
Yeah.
You know, how many bands were made because you got along with someone, whether someone you were involved with, someone that you just resonated with. I mean, this whole idea of resonance, I mean, in some of my more theoretical moments, I think that this notion of pheromonal handshaking is a very important part of why people get together with each other to make music, to make art, to build families, to build communities. Now I'm thinking about quantum entanglement, you know, this very abstract notion of why things form resonances with each other. You know, and resonance is what it's all about.
Yeah. It's an interesting time to talk about community. I mean, all of this stuff is kind of becoming amplified in the face of the coronavirus. And that's an interesting way to think about it. You know, the actual chemistry that's happening between people being together, you know, for the creative process. Has that idea evolved over the course of the past 20 years, watching more and more communities move online?
Well, I call it socioacoustics. I mean, that was my handle for it. And it's certainly been a concern. I mean, before I began to formalize the idea of it, it's something I was thinking about a lot. Why do bands form the way they do? Why do this certain scenes form the way they do? Why do they grow? How do they grow? What we used to be able to do is go to see a gig that was interesting, that was in the realm that you're working. You'd go there and you'd meet other people. Record stores were incredibly important to find people to resonate with. These things do still exist, although they're marginalized. So online is great. If we have nothing else, of course, we have that. But, you know, I mean, I miss hanging out. Hanging out is really how it all got bonded in a very deep way. We hope it's not going to, the online community is going to be the be all and the end all. We want to return to people meeting, because face-to-face meetings are really where it's at, where you want to generate creativity. It's something that creates something larger than itself. And that's what's most important.
Mm-hmm. I mean, in one sense, of course, I'm grateful, you know, as you said, for these online communities, because it's better than nothing. And it allows us to transcend physical spaces and connect with people in ways that would have been much more difficult otherwise. But at the same time, you know, you can sense this withdrawal from what seems, you know, in the way you were describing, like a creative boon of coming to New York and seeking out these spaces that you could turn into collective art spaces to bring people together. Still happens, of course, but not as much. And I'd love to hear how your perspective on that has changed from when you first became involved to what it is today.
Yeah, I accepted with a huge grain of salt the notion that there was a music industry that would see the possibility of making money on creative and extreme music. And it really seemed to be possible, certainly in the 60s, you know, the music industry was based on finding street ears that could tell the marketers what kids wanted to listen to. And so you saw an incredible flowering of music and rock and contemporary music, jazz, everything. I've always been a bit cynical about it all, but yet I labored with the assumption that things would work, and things did work. I mean, I wasn't expecting like kind of pop success. I like to paraphrase the Salvador Dali quote, where he said, "The difference between myself and a madman is that I am not mad." And my own version of it is, "The difference between pop music and my music is that my music isn't popular." But at the same time, I never thought that it couldn't be popular, that why not? Why couldn't people get this, what I was doing? I mean, there's different communities and different constituencies. And as you become older and your work is seen as being associated with a certain time period, your constituency changes. So I began to look more towards Europe and Asia, performing in Japan and China. And most of my work is really in Europe. I think that's where I find the most acceptance as an artist, where people kind of get what I do the best. There was a very good peak period for me in the 80s and 90s in the US, where I was touring a lot, I was on the SST label around the same time that they signed Sonic Youth and Husker Du. They signed Fred Frith and Henry Kaiser. And so we were touring in that scene, and it was very accepting. You know, I could put out a string quartet record or a computer music record, and the audience was there. They headbanged to, you know, like my string quartets. It was great. Oh. You know? And it was fantastic. And you really felt like there was an audience, and the audience was growing, and there was a structure that was working to perpetuate itself, that it was really trying to further reach out and bring more people into this incredibly creative period in music. I think it began to dissipate when the marketers really took control. And I would say that was in the mid to late 90s. Probably my most pessimistic period was with the crash of 2008. Because by then, a lot of money was taken away and a lot of European presenters were taking the American model. So the thing is, in Europe, there is that openness between government, corporate spending, foundations, and community art spaces. There's a fluidity that sees the value in having cultural spaces on a very low level, on a street level, on up to, you know, the grandest opera houses. And because they were losing funding, because everybody was reeling from the economic disaster, they began to look on a model that was dependent not on state funding to subsidize arts, but on ticket sales. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were a lot of art spaces that I worked with that would present, you know, like 20 concerts in season of creative music. And they could count on, maybe if one didn't do as well, they could count on another one packing the place. And because they had funding to control the bottom line, they never had to worry about taking a huge loss. They could always present everything in a season that they wanted to present. But after 2008, instead of presenting 20 concerts in a season, they could only present 8 concerts in a season, and they had to worry about ticket sales. So the things that they began to worry about as being more marginal would then get thrown away. And so the concert seasons began to be more and more predictable. It began to be just the same few people. What is really the saving grace for a lot of contemporary composers is teaching gigs. I've always had short teaching residencies, and those have been great. And these are really a lifeline that allows you to keep going. I mean, I'm also doing online teaching now. I'll do an online workshop in August. It's necessary. And just one hopes that these continue to exist.
Yeah. I mean, hearing that, what would your advice be to someone who's a contemporary composer who's just beginning their career but want to make this kind of music, who want to be experimental, who want to push the envelope? How do you find an audience? How do you connect with people? How do you engage?
You know, you have to find a way to survive if it means taking a day job. If you really know you want to make this music, then you have to find a way to do it. Maybe it means getting in a band that will make popular music. You know, I love popular music that is heartfelt. In the 60s, the bands that were popular were completely contiguous with the people who were making experimental music. Mm-hmm. You talked to Horton Subotnick about his interfacing with the bands from the San Francisco scene and the free jazz scene. It was not a separate world. Contemporary avant-garde music and rock music, psychedelic music, free jazz. And it was all part of a spectrum. And these days, again, the marketing people have separated it. What the music marketing has done is genre-fy everything. And if it doesn't really fit neatly in any of these categories, then it's outside of the realm of sellability. Thank you. I do believe that the musicians themselves find people across the spectrum that they resonate with. I certainly do. I mean, the people I'm in touch with online, the people that I reach through my Instagram feeds or my Facebook, come from all over the musical world, from contemporary composition, from blues, from free jazz, from rock music, from noise. I mean, it's all, to me, it's just all music, you know. I've never felt that those barriers were hard and fast. They were imposed by someone else. You know?
That feels almost utopic to think about when you were describing the 60s and just not having these boundaries between music and having it be, you know, a give and take opportunity to share. Like even thinking about an obvious example like the Beatles, exploring the avant-garde, the countless bands who work with people like Lamont Young, all of these worlds connecting. Is there a way in your mind to return to a musical landscape that is that permeable?
Well, the thing is to not think of return, because nostalgia is dangerous. Mm. You know, we have to continuously find, I mean, the world has changed. What made the New York scene so fertile was cheap rent. You know, you wouldn't have to spend 90% of your time paying rent on an apartment. You could devote yourself to your creative work. You had to be willing to put up with certain conditions. So you have to find different ways of operating. Maybe it means moving to someplace else. One good thing about online communities is geographically, you don't have to be in New York. I was in Detroit a few years ago, a couple of times to do gigs there, and the scene there was fantastic. It felt incredibly fertile and exciting. Berlin is beginning to see the rise in rents. So people are moving to Leipzig, they're moving to Dresden. You know, artists will continue to be creative in finding ways that they can spend their time doing their work and not just enriching a landlord.
Yeah. And I've been interested in this for a long time, but specifically the how this could operate in an online context and how in a digital world, in a capitalist world, things that are not going away, how can we still, and I like what you said, not necessarily return, but at least invoke some of the spirit that led to such a creative output that, you know, happened in the 60s.
Yeah. Back then there was a value for content. And it's become completely devalued. And the question is, how do you wrest the value of content back? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the problem living in a capitalist society becomes, how do we monetize
exactly this?
Because the online communities have devalued. I mean, music has been one of the most greatly devalued arts of all because it's immaterial. I remember the first time I got an online statement, it was like a printout from one of these online services that I signed a contract with. And it was like a telephone book. It showed pages and pages of fine print of streaming downloads. And my kids were saying, what are you looking at, Dad? And I'm sitting here on the couch, like streaming through this, so to speak. And I explained to them what it was. It was for one quarter. This was probably about 10 years ago. And I said, well, do you get money for all this? I said, yeah, look. And at the very last page, there it was, $1.60 for tens of thousands of streams. You know? At the same time, you want to share music. I'm happy that a lot of people can hear music. I go to YouTube and I listen to things that I could never dream of finding back in the day. Maybe it was like 300 copies of a custom pressed vinyl that, you know, no one owned. And now you can listen to it. You know, it's fantastic. So, you know, I mean, I try to remain optimistic because you have to be utopian to do music that doesn't have a popular basis, you know, to hope that it will reach a resonance with a larger population or that you'll find some way of funding it to get it heard and seen. Cool. Okay, Keegan, a pleasure.
Yep. All right, cool. Thanks a lot, Elliot. It's great speaking with you.
Likewise. Take care.
Bye. Yep, you too. Bye. I came away from this conversation thinking about a lot of things, but most notable in my mind were chemistry and precedence. There have been times in history when boundaries weren't rigid and people headbanged to string quartets, when music was just music, when artists embraced the experimentalist because their music was interesting, new, innovative.
and it gave them creative license to push the envelope themselves. And it was all happening in shared spaces where resonance guided people toward one another. A lot's changed since then, and capitalist forces work against this ideal. But we are also living through a unique moment with opportunity on the other side. Opportunity to help choose what the post-corona world looks like, to conduct our social acoustics so that how we resonate in shared rooms matters just as much as the marketing that got us there in the first place. I want to thank Elliot for his time, for the fascinating conversation, and for refusing to pigeonhole himself into any one thing. All of the music you heard in this podcast, all composed by Elliot and used with his permission, reflects that refusal. In the episode's notes, you can find the track names and more resources where you can learn more about him and his music. All of the other sounds on this podcast were done by me. I'm McKeegan Boyce. Community Matters is a production of Grey Matter, where our mission is to build meaningful engagement through human-based music discovery. For more info, you can follow the link in the podcast description. For more evidence of music community, subscribe to the Grey Matter blog on Medium, check us out at greymatter.fm, or follow us on Instagram or Twitter. And tune back in next week, where we'll once again explore why community matters. Thanks for being here.